Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. This is Carl Shinneman, president and founder of ReviewLess, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bites. We're alongside the Honorable Judge Facciola, retired U.S. Magistrate Judge in the United States District Court for the District of Columbia. We attempt to offer information, insights, and ideas about e-discovery innovation from national speakers on electronic discovery at a price everyone can afford, which is free, and available when you're interested in listening to it or downloading it or hitting play on your computer or whatever device you listen to. Today we have an interesting show on how merger and acquisitions might be able to be improved as a process by looking at the risks created by e-discovery, information governance, data privacy, or at least could benefit by looking at these fields to try to figure out ways to improve transactions. And we're meeting with the authors of two innovative publications that they jointly published. The first one entitled Merger and Acquisition Due Diligence, a Proposed Framework to Incorporate Data Privacy, Information Security, E-Discovery, and Information Governance into Due Diligence Practices. That's found at 21 Richmond Journal of Law and Technology 5 from 2015. And a follow-up survey entitled Merger and Acquisition Due Diligence Part 2, The Devil in the Details. These publications were co-authored by James Scherer, Taylor Hoffman, Kevin Wallace, Eugenio Ortiz, and Trevor Satnick. And today we've got three of the authors as our guests. Taylor Hoffman is Senior Vice President and Head of eDiscovery at Swiss Re, a global reinsurer. He's active within the Sedona Conference. He speaks and writes nationally and internationally on eDiscovery issues, and we're thrilled to have him on as a first-time speaker in ESI Bites. James Scherer is of counsel at Baker Hostetler and is also very active in the Sedona Conference and also speaks nationally and on eDiscovery topics. He's co-chair of Baker Hostetler's Information Governance Practice and is based out of New York City. Also thrilled to have you on the show, James. And our last guest is, partly what Judge Facciola loved doing. We got a law student, Trevor Satnick, who's a law student at the Benjamin Cardozo School of Law and Yeshiva University. And it's great to have, new ideas and new blood in the eDiscovery community. So, Trevor, thanks for being involved in the show as well.
Trevor, why aren't you studying for finals?
And then, exactly.
I'm going to begin this week, actually, so I am definitely in the midst of finals prep.
Yeah, I've heard that before.
great first question, Judge. So let's jump into the topic here. First of all, we've got an in-house lawyer, we've got outside counsel, a law student, putting a series of creative articles and studies together. It's very innovative. And I'm curious where the thought came for this, because it's really out of the box. So Taylor, from your perspective, how did the team actually meet and come up with this idea for this publication and the study? And if anyone else wants to chime in, feel free to.
Absolutely. Thanks, Carl. Well, in my practice, I've really firsthand seen the problems of not addressing these issues of e-discovery, InfoGov, InfoSec, and data protection at the M&A stage. And I once received a phone call in my practice from a guy in IT, and he was trying to dispose of a large number of servers. So my first question was, well, what's on the servers? The response was, I don't know. We got it part of XYZ acquisition years ago. Follow-up question. Well, is anyone still around from XYZ Corporation who might know what's on it? The response, no, they've all left or have been terminated. It then became a very costly exercise to identify what that data was to defensively dispose of it. And keep in mind, it's not just an issue when people are terminated, memories also fade and roles change. This is a frequent occurrence, and it could have easily been addressed at the time, but then became unnecessarily time-consuming and expensive endeavor later. So James, who was really the driving force behind the article, and I were discussing the problem. We then asked, well, what are practitioners doing in this realm? how are they addressing these issues? And was there room to move the needle for better practices?
Well, James, if I could ask you a question. When you looked at this, using the word collectively to mean the three of you, what did you see that was missing in the way lawyers approach the issue of due diligence in this area that you found most distressing?
I don't know if it was missing so much as we wanted to see if there was any published guidance. So look, if there was a framework that when we're doing these issues, and I've dealt with some of it. I know Taylor's dealt with some of it. We've had an opportunity to look at these issues and really kind of hash them out. But we thought, well, what are other people who are encountering this issue doing? And we didn't see anything that was just really out there and obvious and evident. So we thought, well, maybe this is a good topic to investigate more fully. And we did that in the first article, really got out there, tried to see what, as it turned out, limited information had been published, and then trying to coalesce that into something that would be more useful as like a practice guide. And in doing that, we identified some other considerations that we were really curious about, and that goes into what Carl had talked about, the second part of the scholarship, which is also due to be published to be next spring in Richmond. If we're not the only ones, and we certainly didn't think that we were, what are other people doing within this space? And that's where the idea of the survey came up. If people weren't affirmatively publishing on it, then what had they written about the actual steps that they'd taken, and what could we better do as far as some guidance was for other people who are encountering the same problems?
So as I said during the introduction, I always like having law students who are entering the field show others how you can make a mark in e-discovery right away, because it's like an open slate, you know, to write on, and you know, in a lot of ways, technology's changing the world so quickly, and it has made law very creative. It's almost like the Wild West. So, Trevor, I was just curious if you could tell us before we jump into this more deeply about your experiences in the project. You know, what you did, how the project's shaping up your future career plans.
Sure. So this past summer, I had the privilege of working under Taylor at Swiss Re as part of their e-discovery management team. And I was always into tech, and one of my main goals entering law school was really to find this intersection point between technology and the law. Of course, that led me down the e-discovery, data privacy, cybersecurity, and information governance pathway. Now, when Taylor and James offered me the chance to work on the paper, researching, comparing, and contrasting various cloud service offerings, looking out for new developments in the M&A space, and helping to create survey questions for various vendors to answer, I jumped at the opportunity. Now, I, like many others apparently, hadn't really considered how these four areas could directly affect a potential success of a merger or acquisition, and I was really excited to see how this stuff worked in practice. So with regard to the future career plans, I was working on the paper, confirmed what I had already assumed, and that was that new tech law areas, as I like to call them, continue to grow and change as we speak. And this growth, I think, I hope, will continue to create opportunities for law students with an interest in these areas, both inside and outside of law firms. And it's definitely the area of practice I'd like to focus on post-grad.
Great. And just because this might be reference material for Trevor, Taylor and James, you know, if an employer is listening to this podcast, just cut to the chase. Would you recommend Trevor based on his work for an immediate interview?
Absolutely.
I don't think we're going to let him get away, frankly.
This summer.
Good.
Budget. All right. Judge, budget.
Now that we got that out of the way, let's start in with the hot topics that you were evaluating in the framework. And, you know, the hot one today is data privacy, and, you know, from the headlines. So, James, why don't you start by discussing data privacy and security and what the field of outside lawyers like yourself are concerned with as risk?
Well, I think data privacy and security, especially these data privacy and related security incidents, it's often not a matter of if, but when. So knowing that you've got a problem that's almost certainly something you're going to have to deal with, you want to find better ways or more efficient ways to deal with the ramifications or the repercussions. So it's not a matter. You might get in an accident, you might not, but you're required to have insurance. We were looking here at the availability of taking good first steps in the context of M&A as one of the very earliest points you'd have an ability to get involved in the discussion. So even when you look at what's changed from the past into the present, you look at how data privacy and security issues have been magnified because of how technology is just so much more incorporated into daily lives. Well, the concerns that we had about moving information, and really that's what this paper is all about, bringing information and attendant risk and responsibilities over from one organization to another during the course of a merger, acquisition, divestiture, or asset purchase. We said, well, what do we have to worry about now? How have things changed in the outside world such that we have to look at these issues or can look more carefully at these issues in a considered matter according to a framework within the course of the transaction? I get the one example I use is information governance, and it relates specifically to data privacy and security and breach response because you don't have to worry so much about information governance within the context of litigation. So if I was before Judge Facciola and there was no disagreement about spoliation or a concern that information was gone missing, my argument would be that any kind of requests for my information governance policy at that point would be premature. We're not dealing with spoliation. That probably shouldn't be an issue. At least that'd be my argument. However, if we're dealing with data breach and response, the problem's already happened. And the regulators will come in and they'll say, I want to see all your policies. I want to see what's happened. What was your operative document for this? What were the circumstances under which this happened? Well, there, we have to have a very good idea. We have to have a good picture. To Taylor's earlier point, once the deal has happened, institutional memories begin to fade. Information about the information itself can start to recede, and we don't have as good a picture as we're required to have in these instances that are more a question of when rather than if.
James, if I may, how does this change things? In other words, how does a merger these days, in 2015, differ from when you would have done in 2001 in terms of these new risks? How do you identify these risks? What are you sensitive to as counsel?
We're sensitive to the known unknowns, most primarily. So this is an instance where the target of the acquisition does know things about that information. And somebody understands why a server was put on the shelf or why it was decommissioned, but there's still information on it. They understand where the backup tapes are held for specific requirements according to SEC regulation or in concerns about how the operation of the business works. Because those are things where those risks and those responsibilities are going to come over with the company. And we're also much more sensitive to how much impact one person can have. Another example may be where people are porting really large sets of data that just weren't available in 2001 or certainly 1991. Someone may have 10 or 20 years worth of emails that they're carting around with them. And it may not even be information from the target that we're acquiring on behalf of the acquirer, but maybe from two companies ago or a company ago. So getting in and digging a little bit and finding out what people know about the information that's coming across the transom, I think that's really where our focus was. And then we could start to delve into the quote-unquote unknown unknowns.
But you are entitled, I take it, to be told of any potential breaches of which the target is aware. But does that do it? Are you also concerned in the nature of the information they have been collecting, which raises these concerns, even if there has not been a breach as yet?
Well, we're interested in both lines. And for the first line, of course, is when it comes to representation about what's known. That's where the Sedona Conference Working Group 11 just had their meeting in Scottsdale. There, the focus in being part of that group is, what are the reps and warranties associated with this? How can these deals be better papered? We're also, though, looking at what are the costs associated with this, both in risks. So how do we mitigate risks? How do we ask the right questions so we've considered this and advanced the ball a little bit? But also, after the deal is done, these post-deal integration costs. Because if we're not allocating money to them, they're a very different animal than they were 10 years ago. The data volumes have just exploded. It is that exponential growth. But if you've got companies with kind of an old mindset to looking at how much it's going to cost to properly integrate these things post-deal, well, that's where the discussion needs to change.
Yeah.
And I would just add on that point, it's not just asking for, you know, what are your potential data breaches or security. It's going in and pressure testing the policies in place to ensure that data breaches don't happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I guess it's also an angle on what they have been collecting and whether the collection in the first place was appropriate. If they have unknowingly been collecting, for example, Social Security numbers, how do you approach that? Do you purge it, protect yourself if they've done something that is just aching with the potential for serious liability?
That's a real issue that we've seen in some of this activity. And again, not a lot of it's been publicized, and that's partly why we wanted to get out and just ask. And the survey was anonymous to see what experiences people had had. We didn't want everything to be anecdotal, but we tried to come up with some kind of structure in which we could elicit this information. But where you talk about protected health information, if you collect that, or if it comes into your IT environment, it is very, very difficult to get rid of it. So to your point, Your Honor, if that comes in with the database and suddenly that database starts showing up on your backup tapes, it is really difficult to disinter information you didn't want to have in the first place that carries little to no value to you as an organization, but suddenly you're stuck with the risk and the responsibilities.
Taylor, based on your research, how does this impact with e-discovery? In other words, obviously, there probably isn't a company on the face of the earth in America that hasn't been sued and doesn't have a litigation hold somewhere. What opportunities did you see that might improve this process when the target has litigation holds or is involved in litigation or litigation is anticipated?
Well, I think as part of the overall due diligence process, the entire point is trying to assess the value of the deal. And more accurately able to ascertain the value. And as you know, Your Honor, the e-discovery practices within a litigation can dramatically change the exposure in a case. So you're already conducting the due diligence on litigation. It makes sense to include as part of that, making sure that holds were in place in those litigation, but also having a conversation with those managing the legal holds to find out how they're implemented and to pressure test it.
And I suppose you also have the problem, Taylor, that there are litigation holds that have been in operation forever, and no one is going to give you even a fair estimate of when it can be lifted. So you may be buying enormous amounts of data that are just sitting there for no apparent purpose.
Absolutely. The matter closeout process is definitely part of that inquiry.
Well, sort of. Go ahead.
No, Carl, I was just handing it to you.
No, the third piece of the framework is information governance, and I guess your little example in the past, Taylor, about the backup tapes and what are they would be a good example of it. My experience, information governance lags behind e-discovery in terms of, even though people talk about it, the budgets for e-discovery are easy to get your hands around because you got a case, you got to deal with it. And data privacy today is in the headlines. So I look at information governance as sort of the orphan child of this area. Trevor, how do you, from your research, how do you measure good information governance? And, you know, did you see any particular risk? Is it just having lots of data floating around that you can't account for?
Sure. Thanks, Carl. Well, information governance, as I'm sure you know, is ultimately defined as the process and controls implemented to manage information held or processed by an organization. Now, not to reuse an old cliche, but information truly is power. Now, good information governance practices can be identified by the establishment of a clear and thoughtful plan by the organization on how to deal with the movement of information both within and outside of that organization. Now, it also helps to have an accountability framework detailing the responsibilities of various parties, and this will bode well for an organization looking to achieve its goals in this area. Of course, waiting patiently for an information crisis to arise before an information governance strategy is implemented can be highly problematic, and this kind of mismanagement can really cripple an organization. Now, in terms of risks, there's, of course, the cybersecurity threat, which is becoming increasingly common and represents a significant risk to organizations undertaking a deal. Integration data sharing can expose organizational assets to confidentiality, integrity, and availability concerns. Now, poor data retention and legal hold processes can result in significant legal headaches for the acquiring organization. And of course, the imposition of sanctions based on poor e-discovery practices can become prohibitively expensive quite quickly. Now, for larger organizations operating abroad, improper access or distribution to personal data may place the acquirer directly in the EU firing line, resulting in fines and penalties due to data privacy concerns. So these areas should obviously be taken seriously at the outset of the deal to avoid encountering a high-cost problem later on.
Trevor, you spoke of silo risks in your article as the different components of a deal. Please tell us about what you meant.
Sure, Your Honor. So an M&A deal is usually undertaken by financial and business managers within both the target and the acquiring organization. Now, those individuals have expertise in a number of specific areas. Often, though, that does not extend to the information governance and information security areas. Outside systems analysts are brought in to determine software and hardware compatibility, while legal and audit functions focus on things like organizational documentation, potential liabilities, and existing and potential internal and external hazards. But information governance and information security tend to operate within their own silos at organizations, whether it's managed by an in-house or outside group. It can therefore be tough to foster cooperation between various silos and silos within silos in the organization. Also, the success of an M&A deal usually sits on top of a very fragile cost calculation. So business and financial managers may not care to see the silo focused on proper information governance blow up a proposed merger, even if it is for the good of the organization, just strictly because the risks may not be properly understood at that juncture.
I see. Carl?
Yeah, that's interesting, because I'll tell you, and you know, it'd be interesting if Taylor or James have any thoughts on this, but you know, we see the same thing just in pure litigation and review in my focus, and that's one reason why we believe the entire team should be talking across themselves on stuff they're seeing, because you don't know what you're looking at until you see it, and it may impact others. And you know, as a litigator who never really did the corporate law they thought they were going to do when they got their MBA before law school, the original plan, this is for you, Trevor, you can plan what you want to do in life. You can go get an expensive MBA. You can put a law degree together, and you can think, I'm going to be a corporate lawyer, and then you become an e-discovery person. Okay? But so I don't know the answer to this, but I was curious, as an e-discovery person, how do you deal in a deal with crossing information across the team? Because that seems to me always the biggest problem you have when you have large groups of professionals.
As far as that communication, it's still new. When we've had experience with these types of deals, it's been a little bit more ad hoc, I think, than any of us would have preferred. But part of that's just because it's a nascent practice. It's taken a long time for e-discovery, I think, to get the type of respect and reputation for being technologically proficient and an understanding that you need some kind of expertise. You need that experience to do it and to do it correctly. Well, you know, we need to retrain corporate attorneys as well to start appreciating that this is part of the deal, just as you had to look at long-tail claims associated with, let's say, asbestos or some of the other chemicals, to say this matters. What you did 40 years ago matters. What you're doing within e-discovery and information governance practices and your related data privacy and security protocols, this matters for the deal, and it's certainly going to matter for the organization who's inheriting all of that data. So we're looking to be involved in those discussions. I think corporate attorneys are starting now to see. One deal I worked on where we had, it was reps and warranties associated with the transfer of data. And the parties, even though it wasn't a European deal, had happened to use a rep and warranty that talked about the European Commission and the application of some of the data privacy concerns. What was nice about that was that the deal team looked at it and said, hey, we don't know what this means. So we want to involve other people who have had some experience, and let's start that discussion. Let's find out, in that case, we represented actually the target. Let's find out what the target's practices are. Does any of this apply? If it does, how do we accurately and completely represent that? And if it doesn't, how do we revise this so that the deal actually represents the transfer that's taking place?
And I apologize for asking the question with almost no possible answer, since we're in an emerging field. But let me focus on something that does happen in deal after deal. And James, you talked about the data after a deal, and you know, what really usually happens to the data after a deal? You know, are there good best practices in information governance to you know, actively gather that data and deal with it and manage it, or is this also an emerging, you know, area that we still haven't got great frameworks for?
It's still fairly organization dependent. So to the points that Trevor had made before, it depends on how the organization deals with the data, what its effective use is of it. We see different organizations handle data internally different ways. Our focus really here was what's going to make the most sense for the acquiring organization. We assume, and maybe this is too big an assumption, but we assume that the acquirer has already taken pains to come up with a framework that works well for them, that internally they're managing their data according to their business calculus, they've done their own risk analysis, they've got protections in place for privacy and security, and when they're receiving data, data that they're responsible for now, how are they going to be integrating that into existing business operations? How are they going to handle that according to the same controls? So for the questions that Taylor had referenced before, when you're going in and asking within the target, okay, what is it that you do? How are things kept? Are there exceptions to your rule? We always say exceptions with scare quotes because everything's exceptional. And what is it going to cost to pull these things into compliance once the deal is done? What happens, though, of course, and you see this in the e-discovery context, is once you go into these organizations who have done a number of these acquisitions, they may not have pulled the new data sets into compliance. And part of that may just be either people haven't been told to focus on it, it hasn't come to anyone's attention, it hasn't caused a problem yet, and then you see litigators end up being fairly expensive post-deal data integrators and saying, okay, well, if you don't know what this is, we may have to go ahead and look at it. You know, we may have some unduly burdensome arguments, but for the most part, you inherited this, so let's see what the deal is, pun intended, and let's start to integrate it at that point in time.
There was some, I understand, follow-up surveying of the idea in a follow-up article. Taylor, what was the point of this survey? How did it differ from the earlier one, and has it been published yet?
Well, the survey we did was really two main buckets. One bucket was, let me back up. It was basically we sent it out to a couple of hundred service providers, and we received a few dozen back, and we were quite pleased with that because we thought, you know, we really needed a critical mass of at least 10, we thought, to get a good insight into the market. But our questions were basically, what are you currently doing in this sphere? And what could you be willing to do, or what are you interested in doing? And so we were really focused on getting a better understanding of how certain technology might assist with the M&A due diligence, and see about the pricing model as well. And the interesting thing was one commented back that even though they weren't currently doing this, quote, as an e-discovery provider, our capabilities can be adapted for any one of the M&A services described. Yeah. So there really is an ability out there. So it's, while it's innovative, it's not going to be a radical heavy lift from the technology or from the service provider perspective. It is more so from the attorney and M&A practitioner's perspective.
And I assume when you get the data after the acquisition, you are free to look at it and take a different perspective of it. In other words, if you think the hold is too broad or you think there's been a poor judgment as to relevance, you can start fresh. I'm guessing you can. And I would assume you would save a lot of money in that way. Why would you don't have to inherit mistakes, do you?
Well, so on the legal hold aspect, I think that good practice is to reassess and make sure that your hold is appropriately scoped throughout. My concern is if you are overly aggressive on that aspect, or you don't do it in conjunction with outside counsel, you can in fact cause some problems as well.
Yeah.
But I think that absolutely that's a good time to reassess and apply best practices.
So for M&A work, the number of vendors, when I looked at the survey that said that they've done a lot of projects, it seemed to be, you know, as you said, James, sort of a Nassian area. There were vendors that had done a handful of projects, you know, 1 to 5, a couple 0, but no one, you know, this was they're a big focus with a lot of volume. Do you think this further indicates how novel these ideas are?
I don't know. It may be that other vendors are doing this in the space, or that it's just conditional on how novel the practice is. My guess is that it is because we're seeing a confluence here. We've had discussions with a lot of people. Taylor tries to get me to stop talking to people about it when for different functions. But it's something that I'm just fascinated with. I think there's a need there, and there is some of this practice happening. It's just it really is a question: is it the e-discovery vendors? Are they involved? But some of the vendors with whom we spoke, though, weren't just e-discovery vendors. I mean, they were technology providers. They provide a number of these different related services. They want to do the work, and our contention is that the work is going to be there through these deals. So it may just be what gets it on people's radar, what makes people understand that there's a value to this work, or can be a value to this work, and a need for professionals with some expertise to perform the services.
And on that, I think that we should keep in mind a little bit the self-selecting process. So 60% reported that they're currently performing M&A due diligence work. But if I'm a service provider who's never done this before, I don't know how to spell M&A, I'm not going to be part of the survey. So I don't think it's a representative sample of service providers, and underscores the point of the innovation.
Yeah, I've been involved in a couple sales of businesses that I've been an owner in, and we were using technology providers to build review rooms that were purely M&A related vendors. I would never have known to have called them. They were tied into the deal making community, but they would not have really understood e-discovery. I think it's really interesting to sort of tie the two together, because the technologies are somewhat similar. Data security in a hosted environment. But anyway,
Taylor, were there any surprises in the data? Things that really caught you by, amazed you? You had no idea you'd find it?
You know, that 60% number on first blush did surprise me, because, you know, that's the majority, right? But then delving into the numbers a little bit more suggests that it wasn't quite as common, because about half said five or fewer clients had ever asked for these services. And when you also think about it, a lot of this could be for hosting the due diligence data room only and not providing these additional analytical tools. The second surprise for me was that only a quarter provide compliance conflicts and proposed strategies for cross-border data transfers. Well, your big deals, even your medium and small deals, are going to involve cross-border data. This is a problem, and this needs to change.
More people have to stub their toe, maybe. Could happen. Work for the judges. But anyway, I guess the first case Judge Shindlin gets her hand on with a cross-border transaction, maybe. Is there anything in the data, James, that had you encouraged?
I liked that, and I thought this was good commercial practice too. I liked that the companies who participated in the survey were finding ways to make this work, who looked at it, and for them or for their practices, it made sense. Our hope had been through the first article that we were presenting this case for doing a lot of these practices where, to Taylor's point, the strengths of the e-discovery vendors should fit in this space. If you want to talk about ways in which you can create data rooms and good controls around them, that you can present data in a way that's viewable and you can apply analytics to, well, this is an area that should be ripe for some kind of improvements, and certainly for some healthy competition. I've done some of this due diligence work, and some of the data rooms in which this work is performed are just extremely unsophisticated. We know what we can do within the e-discovery tools, and what types of value those environments can provide. You know, the hope is maybe that's another inroads into the practice here, where we say, okay, maybe you don't fully appreciate everything associated with e-discovery or good practices, but even while you do the deal itself, this is going to help within this due diligence component in really marshaling your facts and about it.
I take it you noticed that there was a significant indication that most of the billing in this area was hourly. as opposed to being a more systemic solution that all corporations kind of use. Did that strike you as odd? And what does it suggest, if anything, about how the process is working?
To me, it meant that they just hadn't done much of it.
Yeah.
So it while you're still feeling your way around, the chances are, well, we don't want to get stuck bidding a $10,000 bid for a $100,000 project, especially if we've only done one before. And within due diligence, too, it's funny because there are a lot of unknown unknowns as well as known unknowns. So you're coming into it and you're feeling around in the dark a little bit. What we'd proposed, too, was if we're really doing full deal integration with this information, as we're pulling it from the target and we're going to install it into or integrate it into the organization after the deal, that's a big project. And vendors, if they're looking at helping us ascertain the deal volumes beforehand, should look at it as the beginning of probably a pretty long-standing and successful relationship. So hopefully the vendors will, as this practice grows and, of course, as it matures when it comes to the way in which you bid it out, the hope is that at the front end, the vendor work would actually be pretty inexpensive. You're going to earn a lot of value because the vendors look at it and say, okay, well, you want to move this data. You want to integrate it into your practices. You want to get rid of some of it in the best times for you to do that before you inherit some of the risk. But for the rest, hey, we can process it for you. We can put this data into usable form. You can download it, or you can keep it with us. We can host it. We can make it available to you. You can use the tools that you're used to. We can provide value by being a data host for this deal for the data from the deal, and that business relationship will be ongoing. So while it's billable now, that the framework will allow some of that work to change into a relationship where everyone benefits.
No, I think that's fantastic to push a disruptive force into that space. And if it gets to the level where some of the analytical tools are used, which we've been working for, you know, it seems like years trying to get more lawyers to use the analytical tools, that can only improve, a deal analysis. Sort of in that vein, Taylor, I remember reading a similarly creative law review article by Jonathan Redgrave and Jay Bruds that tried to bridge different practice areas of lawyers between litigators and corporate lawyers and proposes a very creative idea of contracting away e-discovery risks, such as deciding in your contract up front how many custodians would be the target of a hold, or what would be the trigger of preservation in a contract instead of waiting for litigation. And I always thought it was a great idea. We did an ESI Pites podcast on that article too, but the biggest challenge I see with educating practitioners who are further removed from e-discovery spaces, we have a hard time educating the litigators to do these things, and now we're moving into a different set of lawyers. So do you see similar risks or challenges with trying to reach out to corporate lawyers with a different idea that's sort of based on e-discovery or those related areas?
Absolutely, Carl. I enjoyed that podcast, and in it, Jonathan Redgrave talked about the natural temperament of lawyers being resistant to change.
Really?
Hey, that's what Judge Facciola says is common law working. It just takes hundreds of years, right?
And it is, I think it is more difficult because, your litigators may not be where they should be on e-discovery issues, but at least they know it's part of the process, that they've at least, pulled out an email to have as part of the deposition exhibit. And, your senior corporate M&A partner, might think e-discovery is just something that summer associates talk about or Trevor talks about. So you certainly have that challenge where there's not an appreciation for these issues. I think you also have a challenge in big deals when the M&A partner is worried about getting regulatory approval and, big numbers involved and thinking that e-discovery, InfoGov, why are you bugging me with this? And might push it away. So I think that's also a challenge that we face. But it's not an insurmountable challenge. I think the key here is that each role needs to play a part in fixing it. Law firm lawyers like James need to cross-functionally have these conversations within their firm. So James's M&A partners are aware of this. He needs to educate his own firm. Clients also have to play a role. We need to demand it. It's a better practice with a clear ROI. And I think service providers should also be involved in pitching it. I mean, that was one of the takeaways from the survey, is that there is certainly an interest in this undeveloped market where they have the skill set, they have the technology, it's just applying it in a different context.
I must share with you as we conclude, I recently published an article about technological competence in law schools and the ABA professional lawyer. I was on a panel. Another member of the panel is a wonderful professor from Villanova who studied lawyers and resistance to technological change and found that lawyers did not use a telephone for the first 10 years of their existence, which led me to wonder whether they used the elevator. So good luck. You are not preaching to the choir. You're preaching to the devil and his group. But...
The Vikings used to use strategic smoke towers to light fires to communicate.
Yeah, well, I know where I'd like to light a few of those fires, but I won't go into that. This is a family podcast. But
well, any plans for follow up research on this project? We'll sort of close out the show with that. And
I think that surveys like the one we conducted here are extremely important as they provide us with an idea as to what's truly occurring in practice and not just in theory. I think it would be great to come back to this after certain areas like the cross-border data transfer area and cyber risk legal frameworks are more mature, and then analyze how the services and the focus areas of vendors with regard to these M&A deals have changed over time. That I think would be really great, but we'll have to see.
Great. All right. Well, I'd like to thank Taylor, Trevor, and James for joining Judge Facciola and myself today on this ESI Bites discussion. And if you have any questions about this show or other programs at ESI Bites, feel free to email me at kas@reviewless.com. I'd also like to thank our sponsor, Jurnov, for their continued support of ESI Bites. And to the listeners, if you've enjoyed this podcast, I'd encourage you to go to www.esibytes.com with a Y for a complete list of our shows. And as we always say here, come to ESI Bytes, learn more about eDiscovery before ESI bites you back. This is Carl Schinneman, president and founder of ReviewLess, wishing you a nice day.